Right, we're going to attempt to do chapter 3 today of the book of Ruth. I just wanted to say this by way of comfort. This morning we talked with the ladies in the jail about the sure justice of God. That if God says something and His word is disobeyed, there will be justice. There'll be prompt justice. We talked about Uzzah there in chapter 6 of 2 Samuel when he put forth his hand to touch the ark, and how that had he not decided, how David not decided to do things his way, contrary to the word of God, contrary to how God had taught him to do it, that Uzzah wouldn't have been put in that place. And we correlated that to the text in Proverbs 14:12 there, that there is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. And I made the statement to the ladies that we think that it's difficult, and David was displeased with what God did to Uzzah, but we think that when we think about the fact that justice is sure and swift, and that God's word is accurate, that if He says this is a consequence and it will be done, it will be so, the converse is true. We can rest comfortably in the fact that if He promises us something, it will be true. And we think about how often as parents and grandparents we say, if you do this, then I'll do that, and we don't. If God were like that, then we could not rest in the promise that He gives us that says, I'll supply all your needs. My grace is sufficient. If you obey my commandments, you'll be like a tree that's planted by the water. All of these wonderful promises that He gives to us for comfort, we could not rely on if we saw Him waver in His administration of justice. So there is that continuity and that comfort in seeing that God is true and certain and sure in His entire word. There's no part of it at any time that we can doubt, that we need to doubt. We can rest in it, absolutely assured that God will do what He says. And so we talked about that comfort this morning. And that applies here in chapter 3 of the book of Ruth. And for sake of time, we won't read the entire chapter. We'll just read it as we go through it. I will say this, is an extremely controversial chapter. In fact, I thought it was interesting that there's not much said on it among any of the commentators. And even when I went online and tried to find out, research certain aspects of this chapter, it was still silence in a great many things. And I like to do character studies in the Old Testament and the New Testament because God, this is a biography here as well. And we can learn from the lives of these people who truly lived. They really lived. We can look at them and we can see scriptural principles in their lives that can apply to our lives. We can learn from their bad errors in judgment. We can follow things that they do that are right and good. And so I like to look at that, and in looking at this, a lot of the commentators just want to say, well, this is just one segment of the genealogy of the earthly line of Christ, and it's just showing this, the picture of Boaz as a redeemer, kinsman redeemer, and Ruth as the bride of Christ. And I understand that, and I don't want to minimize it. But on the other hand, we need to look, and we took a long time in chapter 1 laying that foundation as we looked about how this all came about in the first place. How did Ruth even get back to Bethlehem in the first place? So there are things here that we can learn from looking at each of these characters individually. And of course, we spent a good bit of time on it, but at the end of the day, we've only accomplished just a survey. So as we get ready to conclude this, if there are ideas or opinion that you have about any of these people, we will discuss them and we'll talk about them. The one thing, though, that we have to be careful about is that when the scripture is silent, we have to be careful about going off into conjecture. Albeit, there are things that we can see if we'll just be willing to look closely, like Sherlock Holmes, and get down there and look at each little minute detail. We can learn things. You can learn a lot if you'll study people. My grandmother, on my mother's side, was a wonderful Scotch-Irish lady, and she used to go and sit in the, she had an old 1930s Packard. I don't know if that was the car she had, but Mom said she used to go and park on the square, and she would just sit and watch people. She said she would tell the girls, you know, you can learn so much if you'll just watch people. And I've often done that, just watch people, and the things that they do, the things that they say, actually reveals a lot about their character. And you don't have to have some great, big, huge catastrophe. You can learn about a person if you are astute in looking at what they're doing just in their day-to-day lives. And I used to tell my boys that, and my daughter, if when you're looking, and a lot of my students, when you're looking at somebody that you think you might want to marry, it's not the big things they do. It's the small things. And we see that in the scriptures as we study these sketches, these biographical sketches of people we meet. We see certain things about them and we realize, oh my, I see that in people that are walking around today. But people aren't different. We all come from Adam. And so there's a great deal we can learn by looking at these people. However, as I said, we have to be careful that we don't go too far into the realm of conjecture. But in defense of kind of branching out a little bit, just like in our text this morning in Numbers, Moses was complaining there in Numbers 11. But if you think about it realistically, it's like reading a diary. Just of short entries there. We don't know what Moses did day after day after day after day. Of the overwhelming amount of work that he had to do. I mean, we're standing here thinking about what we have to do tomorrow to start our work week. And I mean, each one of us is like, I don't want to do this. And yet, we forget that Moses faced that same thing. When the next day came, or the day after the Sabbath, he began all this work again, and he was responsible for it. And what would we have done in the same situation that he was in Numbers 11? How frustrated you could get. You think about situations that you have day to day. And you know, we were talking also in the jail this morning about Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turneth away wrath, but how many times do we get blindsided and something happens and we're frustrated and we just mouth off? So we see there the absolute humanity of Moses, and we forget that there were a lot of things that Moses did routinely, daily, monthly, yearly, that weren't recorded in the scriptures. And yet, we have to take that into account when we come to a text, like we came to in Numbers today, where he said this. What prompted that? What prompted it? And it's the same thing with us. When we get to where we get, we're overwhelmed, we're frustrated, we're tired, we're whatever as a woman that is going on in our lives, and we have a downturn in our lives, or we're low spiritually, why? What precipitated that? What brought us to that place? And that's what we're seeing here in this this little narrative here of Ruth and Naomi. And so having said that, I kind of wanted to lay a groundwork so that when we branch out and make some comments about Naomi, you'll understand that we're just trying to learn here from Naomi. It's not that it's hard. It wasn't necessarily spoken in the scriptures, and yet we know that she lived. She was a normal woman, and she had failings and shortcomings just like all of us. And maybe we can get glimpses of the type of character that she was, or personality and so forth, if we're careful to look at what the Holy Spirit actually did record. So as we start chapter 3, we left Ruth. She was to glean in the barley harvest, and then she was to follow Boaz's maidens to all of his fields. And we said the last time we were together, that the typical time of harvest ran from the Passover to the Pentecost, which was about 50-something days there, 2 to 3 months in just general terms. And she was to follow the maidens, and she was to harvest. Now, if she had the prosperity through the entire harvest time that she had that first day, she was going to do well. And incidentally, I printed off a picture. This is how, it's difficult for you to see, but this is a stick that they would have beat out the grain with. She's holding it. You can look at this. She's holding her foot there on the stalks and then just beating the heads of it for the grain to fall out. This would be a small portion of grain. And we talked about last week that after she harvested, after she did all of her work there that day, then she did this. She beat the grain out with a stick and actually took that home to Naomi. So we see there that she was industrious. I mean, so far to this point, there's really nothing about Ruth that we can't admire. So we begin then chapter 3 and verse 1, and it says there, in verse 23 of chapter 2, she had kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean into the end of barley harvest and of wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee?" Now, Naomi just says her intention to seek rest for Ruth. And we know that rest in the New Testament there in Hebrews is the Sabbath, which is the blessing of the Sabbath to go home to be with the Lord. But in the Old Testament, the Sabbath was a picture of that perpetual rest of being with the Lord. But the idea of rest here that Naomi was speaking about could have been rest not just from the work of gleaning, which is all Ruth would have had to have looked forward to if she were not married, but the rest of having a husband to care for her. And so Naomi may have believed that this was her duty to go about to get Ruth, to orchestrate things so that Ruth maybe could be married again. And in verse 2 we see, "And now is not Boaz of our kindred," this is Naomi speaking, "with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash thyself therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lieth down that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do." Now, let's look here at a few notes as we go through these directions of Naomi. First of all, in verse 2, she assumes that Ruth understands the law of the kinsman redeemer and that Boaz is their near kinsman. They've evidently discussed this. And Edersheim noted that the interesting thing about this law of the kinsman redeemer is that the law is fixed on the kinsman, has fixed on the kinsman the duty of redeeming the piece of land. But it did not connect with the obligation of marrying the childless widow, which strictly speaking falls to the brother-in-law. Now, for reference, that's Leviticus 25:25. Leviticus 25:25. Here we have, if thy brother be waxen poor and has sold away some of his possession, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold. And if the man have none to redeem it and himself be able to redeem it, then let him count the years of the sale thereof and restore the overplus unto the man whom he sold it, that he may return unto his possession. And then it talks about the what to do if no one can redeem it. But there's nothing said there about the wife. However, if we look at Deuteronomy 25:5-8, we find the directions there if there's a widow involved. Deuteronomy 25:5, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without a stranger, without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him, and if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. So we see in Deuteronomy 25:5-8 that if the man doesn't want to take his brother's wife, and the marginal translation there, brother, is kinsman, then the wife has an act of retribution against this man. She can take his shoe, spit in his face, and mark him as the man who wouldn't raise up a seed to his son, to his brother. Now, the interesting thing is, God held this law. If you remember, in fact, in this family lineage here, in the tribe of Judah, when Judah's son was married to the woman Tamar, and you remember this story, and then he died, and Onan would not, he spilled his seed and would not allow the woman to have a son to his brother's name, and then it went on down at succession, and then Tamar finally tricked Judah into, and she got her children that way by her father-in-law. And so we see that God killed Onan because he spilled that seed rather than obey this law in Deuteronomy 25. Now, Naomi intended to invoke the law of kinsman redeemer, not in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy. And she realized, no doubt, by this situation we have in Ruth chapter 3, that she was invoking something that did not apply to her. Because the property now was, and the widow that was to be redeemed was her son's widow. It didn't apply to her, it applied to Ruth. And Ruth then was the one, not Naomi, who would have to lay claim to the redemption of herself. According to Deuteronomy 25, it was the widow of the deceased. Now, Naomi then lays out her plan by noting to Ruth that this is the night that Boaz would be at the threshing floor, out of the city and away from his home. And Dr. Gill says that would be a neutral place. I thought that was interesting. He didn't go into any elaboration, and no one else did either. And this is where we become mystified, because Ruth had that right of kinsman redeemer. She could have requested that the next of kin redeem the property and her in her widowhood according to Deuteronomy 25. And yet, for some reason, Naomi has come up with this plan that Boaz would be at the threshing floor in a neutral place. She instructed Ruth to wash and anoint herself and change out of her work clothes, which probably had also been her widow's weeds. She probably was still wearing the dress of widowhood, but at any rate, she was wearing work clothes. And to put on her better dress, and one of the commentators said it was her ornamental clothing from Moab. Another one said it was her Sabbath clothing. At whatever rate, we're told that she was to anoint herself, to bathe and anoint herself. Now, some people said she put on perfume. This could be doubtful, because if you're in a threshing floor at night with a lot of men and you're attempting to hide and you have on perfume, I don't think you're going to do well, even in the darkness. Plus, you're going to leave that lingering scent. Now, I'm not denying that that women of the Orient, of the Eastern countries, perfume themselves with various spices. But it's also probable that Naomi just instructed her to anoint herself as we would put on, like, olive oil. If you read in the antique literature, you'll find of the antiquities, you'll find that a lot of times women anointed themselves with olive oil. Even the men did. One of the passages in the book of Odysseus, he's put up on shore after a shipwreck, and after he's rescued, he bathes himself and he anoints himself with olive oil. Now, olive oil wouldn't be smelly, and you wouldn't detect it. And after her hard work, it would still give, emulsion to her skin and whatnot, but it wouldn't be odory, an odor like a perfume. So it's possible that that's what she did. Whatever the case, she told her to put on clothing that was different than she had been working in. Then she instructed her to go down to the threshing floor, but not to make herself known to any man. Now, this part of the direction is interesting. And this is where some commentators ventured to ask questions. And the Jewish Targums go ahead and make some speculation. Is Ruth to hide from everyone? Or just the general public? Those who worked for Boaz, it would be okay if they knew her. But she was to hide. We don't know. Was she to hide because she was no longer in her work clothes and her presence there in her dress clothes could be misconstrued? If she had come in work clothes, it would have been reckoned that she had come to work for whatever reason. However, being in dress clothing may have given the whole situation a vulgar or vile motivation. And Naomi told her she was to remain out of sight until the workers lay down for sleep. Naomi obviously meant that not even Boaz himself was to know that Ruth was there until he had lain down and gone to sleep. That's the intimation that we get here. Now, just by way of a little history, Jewish women, they bathed regularly. There was an idea of bathing, and no one would have thought it unusual. Usually it coincided with the woman's monthly cycle. She was to take a bath, and the bath that was provided in each little town was to be deep enough that she could cover her head if she stood in the bottom of the water. In other words, she was to get a good bath. And it wasn't uncommon that she would have bathed. Nobody would have thought that out of the ordinary. She wouldn't have drawn any unusual attention to herself. But to have shown up at the threshing floor without her work garb on. And I was thinking about this because in doing some research, in the threshing floors are still used in some parts of the Middle East. And the in one of the places in the research that I found in Syria, the whole family went down to the threshing floor and they built a little booth, and the woman would actually take part in the threshing because they would hook up oxen. They would lay all the harvested grain out, the stalks, out on this open place, this big open place. And sometimes it was up on a hill, but most of the time it was just an open field. And they would lay it out, and then they would take an oxen that was pulling like a sledge. And the sledge had rocks and metal pieces on the bottom of it. And they would just pull him around and around and around until he broke the stalks up and the heavy heads of grain would fall. And then they would bring him off, bring the oxen off, and then they would winnow it with a fork, like a long pitchfork, and just stand there and just throw it up into the wind. That's why it was done out in an open space where the wind would be blowing. And it could catch the chaff and drive it away. And so oftentimes in Syria, according to this one source, the women, the mothers and the children would ride on that sledge to give it extra weight. And as they would drag it around and around and around that threshing floor. So I thought, well, perhaps if Naomi went down to the threshing floor dressed in her work clothes, even if the custom in that area was not for women to be there, if it was only for men to be there, if she were a Moabitess, they might have excused her being down there if she had come down to work. And someone would have just said, no, this is not the way. And I laugh because when we were on the mission field, everybody drove on the wrong side of the road. And I remember lots of times turning on the wrong side of the road. And I was driving along and somebody was coming at me. And I used to always say, please forgive me, I'm an American. Well, she could have said the same thing. Please forgive me, I'm a Moabitess. But the fact that she was there in her dress clothes would have said to anybody in Bethlehem, I didn't come to work. And so there is where the problem comes in my view. Why would Naomi come up with this? Then she said that Ruth was to note where Boaz lay down. She was to wait for darkness, go onto the floor, uncover his feet, and lie down. Now the commentators do not defend this behavior. However, Gill notes that Naomi was advising as she did, because she again was still working with this idea of this kinsman redeemer law in her mind. And according to this law, Naomi regarded Boaz as already being Ruth's husband. This consideration, if she worked with this consideration, then she that would have allowed Ruth to put herself before Boaz and to make this demand of marriage. However, I still am uncomfortable with this idea of Naomi instructing her to do this. And as we look at Naomi, if we just hone in on Naomi for a minute and leave Ruth, if we hone in on Naomi, we go back to our first chapter and we say, you know, we were just making the conjecture there, perhaps Elimelech wasn't on his own in making the decision to go to Moab. Perhaps Naomi had a large input in it. Perhaps she was uncomfortable in her situation and she wanted comfort in Moab. And there may be some substance to that by the fact that she didn't come back when she could have. When her husband died, she didn't come back. She stayed in Moab. That's a possibility. But why would she risk Ruth? In this number of days that she's been there, surely she would have inquired about the relatives of Moab, of Elimelech, who were still living. Because even according to this law in Deuteronomy, Ruth was to have been redeemed by a brother. By a brother first. Both of her sons were dead. So there was no kinsman redeemer. In that then, it was to pass to the, it was to be the husband's brother, the deceased husband's brother, and then to a full cousin. So, why would she not have inquired, if she wanted to provide rest for Ruth, why would she not have inquired in a more legal manner? She had the law on her side. Why would she not have done like our Shunammite lady and present herself to the king, who had a legal right, a legal petition to the king, I need my land back, and it was supposed to have been granted to her? Why did Naomi not present herself to the elders of the city and ask that the lineage be found that would allow a kinsman redeemer to come forward and redeem the property and redeem Ruth? That's a question that I did not find an answer for, and we're not told in the scriptures. But the fact of the matter is that Boaz had showed an inordinate amount of hospitality in allowing Ruth to follow his reapers in the entire season and to be as generous as he was. And, you know, I don't want to put ulterior motives into Naomi's into Naomi here, because the scripture doesn't say it. But I look back at women in the scripture who have known what God's purposes were, and they tried to rush them up. We look at Sarah. God didn't give a child, so she concocted this marriage with Hagar to get this promised seed. And that didn't work. Then we look at Rebecca. Rebecca knew that there were twins in her womb and that the elder would serve the younger, and she got panicky. And she said, let's do this. And she told her son, you do what I tell you, knowing full well she was not doing right. And then we look at Rachel. She tried to buy a night with Jacob with some mandrakes. And so we see this going on. It's not a new thing. It's not even new to us. And I was smitten thinking in my own life at the times that I've had very good intentions, I thought. Very good intentions, but I couldn't wait for God to do it. So I helped him out. And it never works out. And I'm warning you, from experience, I'm not criticizing you or condemning you. I'm warning you, as younger women, be careful. This is our disposition as women to help things along. And especially if it deals with our children. And sometimes if it deals with our own provision or our own comfort. We know that God is going to do that. Yes, I understand that the promises of God are true and sure. And in the case of Sarah, she actually heard the angel say it. And so did Rebecca. And Naomi has this law, this kinsman redeemer, she can hold on to. And yet we often go ahead and try to move the process along. And we have to be careful, because that is sin, and there are consequences to sin. And yes, God forgives us, but no, he does not remove those consequences. Sadly. And we set things in motion. As far as we know in the scripture, Rebecca did not see Jacob again. We're not told that she ever did, or any of her grandchildren. So we have to be careful that we don't set in motion these consequences. So having said that, you know, that's the thing that I think about in this narrative, is that where was Naomi in the whole process of getting to Moab? Why did she not get back home again like our Shunammite lady before her sons married Moabites? Why didn't she try to persuade Orpah and Ruth to follow her God there in Moab? You see, these are questions that I have. When she comes back in, she admits to the ladies that the Lord has dealt bitterly with her. She doesn't say, I followed my husband and now look what happened to me. No, she said he dealt with her. And then we see now that she's sitting there in the house watching this process of gleaning going on the whole time. The Lord's providing for her. And she says, you know what, Ruth? I'm going to get you rest. Now, I wonder if she didn't see that maybe there was a feeling there that she could use between Boaz and Ruth. Because what she was asking Ruth to do, if it had not worked according to her plan, it would have spelled disaster for Ruth. She was already an outsider. She was going to be down there at the threshing floor in the dark of night, in her dress clothes, lying at the feet of an unmarried man. And what could have been everything could have been misconstrued about that against Ruth. Then, when she comes back to the village, how could she have been allowed to have gleaned again? How could she have not been labeled a harlot? She was already Ruth the Moabite. So this was really, really risky business. As I'm reading this, it's risky business. And every commentator was virtually silent on it because there is no reason or rhyme for it. Now, going back to verse 4, we see that Jameson Fawcett Brown, the commentators, they said there would have been no impropriety in those times in Bethlehem because this was a method of reminding Boaz of the duty of the kinsman. Ruth was to lie crosswise at his feet, which was the position in which Eastern servants frequently slept with their master. Custom allowed the servant to use part of the master's covering. There would have been no indecency, even in the case of this being a woman, since the custom was to sleep in the same clothes that they wore during the day. That may be true, but if she had been in her work clothes, that would have been fine. But the fact that she had bathed, she had on her dress clothes, she had anointed herself, now she's going to take this posture. How could that have been misconstrued? So it was still risky, as I see it. For whatever reason, Naomi was willing to risk all of this, and she counseled Ruth that Boaz would not be affronted at the fact that she was there in that floor like that. So Naomi was operating on the premise that when Boaz realized it was Ruth and that Ruth was dressed in her good clothes, that he wouldn't be offended, but that he would be kind and gentle and tell her what to do next. And so Ruth, again, I believe, displays the genuineness of her testimony. She said, all that thou sayest unto me, I will do. And so we see then that, again, she is doing exactly as Naomi has instructed her. She went down to the floor in verse 6 and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. In verse 7, and when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn, and she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. So we see here then that so far, everything has come as Naomi had planned it. When Boaz asked who was there, Ruth responded and asked that he spread his skirt over her, which was the figurative of taking her in marriage. This is the same figure of speech that is in the account there in Ezekiel chapter 16, and I do trust that you will go home and read that. I never tire of thinking of that beautiful picture of salvation there, where the baby is born out in the desert in that camel caravan. And because it's a little girl, it's just left there in its blood, in its birth blood. And the Lord said, I came along and I saw you and I spread my skirt over you. He took her and washed her and provided for her. And what a beautiful picture there. And so Ruth asked this of Boaz. And Gil speaks of the Jewish marriage custom of the man casting the skirt of his outward garment over the head of his bride. Now, he's not saying that this was the custom used at the time of Ruth, but others did speak of this custom in all those lands in that area of as a symbolic action of protection. And even today, they say it's still synonymous with the indicating of marriage, and it's actually a part of the marriage ceremony in which the bridegroom puts his cloak over or around the bride to indicate that she is now under his protection. It could also remind us of the analogy that we used in the second chapter there of the hen bringing her chicks in under her wings, or the Shekinah glory of the mercy seat under the cherubim there. Whatever the case, Ruth invoked that law of the kinsman redeemer. She said to him, you are the one that has the right to redeem me. Now, Boaz's response, this just shows the beauty of Boaz as a picture of Christ. What a gentle and kind and dear man he is. He said in verse 10, blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter. For thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman, howbeit there is a kinsman nearer than I. So Boaz blesses her, and then he reiterates her testimony, as he had done the day that he met her. And then he says that this action of hers tonight is greater than everything she's done to this point, in that she is willing to marry the kinsman to redeem the property and to pursue the child to preserve the family name. He recognizes that she had not followed after younger men, whether they were rich or poor. And the Jews seem to think here that this indicates that he was an older man. Some even say he was 80 and she was 40, but we don't have any indication of that. But he evidently was older in that he was a great man. He was a leader in the area. He was a man of wealth. So he no doubt was older, and she was still willing to marry him and to honor the family that she had married into. Now, supposedly Ruth was young enough and possibly of a beauty that she could have remarried in her own country of Moab. And it's possible that she could have even married a younger man in the adopted country there in Israel, in Bethlehem of Israel. Just any marriage, though, would not necessarily have helped Naomi, because whomever Ruth would have married would not have been required to care for Naomi. So that wouldn't necessarily have helped Naomi, and it certainly wouldn't have raised a child up to carry on the family name of the dead husband. It would only have satisfied Ruth. So here was another indication of the sureness of her testimony. She had, to this point, acted in every way that verified that the God of Israel was her God. Now, she's intending to follow the precedent of the kinsman redeemer. Why? To retain the legacy of Naomi's family, which was her family. Now, here's a lesson for us who marry husbands, and all of us here have been in this situation. We must be careful to understand and follow the biblical instruction that we are now in the husband's family. And just a little aside here, just historically speaking, in the biblical, in the Bible days, and we read in Matthew there where the Lord uses the wedding as a picture, the 10 foolish virgins and the wise virgins. The betrothal period lasted sometimes a very long time. But the idea of the betrothal was that the man would go and he would work out the dowry with the father, and they would settle on an amount, and the daughter then would become the betrothed of this young man, and then he would go back to his father's property, and he would prepare her a place to live. He would prepare all the things that she would need, basically to set up housekeeping and to become a member of that family. And sometimes if they were poor people, the whole family lived in the one room. But if they were wealthy enough, he would build a little addition on to the house or build her a house. It just depended on their status. But that interim, that betrothal period, was used to prepare for this wife. And then you find in Matthew, the bridegroom going at night, he would go when this was all done, and he would take her from her father's house. And she would be escorted down the streets, through the streets or whatever, to her husband's house, and she would no longer be in the family of her mother and father. She would now be in his house. And it's not like, you know, I'm sure you can't, there, it's not the idea that she just forgot all about them, but she legally was not their family anymore. She was the husband's family. So every duty was to that family. To bring up children, to care for the husband, to care for the parents, to care for the inheritance. Whatever she did was for that new family. We see that in the story, the beautiful story, where Eliezer went to get Rebekah for the wife. And Laban said, well, let's call her. And even in the Jewish families, the daughter had the right to speak. And Laban said, let's call her. Rebekah, what do you say? And she said, I'll go. And then he said, well, let her stay here for a time. And Eliezer said, no, I've got to go now. And Rebekah said, I will go now. So she left, and she traveled all that distance knowing that probably she would never see her family again, but that's fine because she became the daughter of Abraham. She became his child. She was in the family of Abraham at that point. So we see here then that the whole family joins together, typically in the selection of an appropriate husband, but her wishes were taken into account, and we quote it here in Genesis 24. And it's interesting that even in Deuteronomy 21, when it's dealing with what do you do with women you capture in war, even the female war captive, to some extent, she was given a month to mourn for her family before she was married to a captor. But once she was married, she was no longer part of that old family. If it seems to us, and one of the commentators said, if it seems to us that the choice of a husband was a matter for the whole family to determine, we must remember that the young woman was allying herself not only with her husband, but the whole family. The couple would not form a nuclear family in our modern sense, for they were virtually unknown in ancient society, but they would become a part of a larger family. Thus, the girl's family had to be sure, first of all, that she was marrying someone whose family and way of life would be compatible with hers. You see what could happen when you don't do that? And then she would probably be living and working with these people for the rest of her life. So that was their foundation for a more or less an arranged marriage, which I have a dear friend that's from India. They arrange marriages. She said it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And I'm inclined to agree from my vantage point that it is wonderful because the whole family participated in understanding and the fact that these two people are coming together to form a home to rear children. Can they be compatible with each other? Can they be compatible in the broader sense? And as your children grow up and you're faced with this, particularly in our culture where it's frowned upon to have those kinds of rules and stipulations, what are you going to do? Because it introduces a whole host of problems when we try to mix up things and mingle up things, even in a church situation. But I think the biggest lesson here is that we definitely never want to condone a marriage of a person professing Christ and one who is not professing Christ. Now, I worded that way because a lot of people say they're Christians. If your child ends up in a relationship with someone who says, I'm a Christian, but his life is not Christ-like, as far as you're concerned, they're not a Christian. Because we're talking about a covenant relationship. We're talking about a relationship that is a molding together, a coming together of two into one, and it is the propagation of a family. And Ruth saw that. And she didn't trip over to Bethlehem in a light manner and name the name of Christ. I want to be with you. She took on the responsibility that was on her shoulders as the widow of a Bethlehemite. And we've got to get serious about understanding that. Because that, God said we're to have godly seed. How are we to do that if we're careless about mixing and mingling with the world? Even with someone who professes to be Christ, and then you bring a child into the world, what do you do? So you want to be sure of that compatibility, particularly in the Word of God, that you will bring forth a godly seed, and that godly seed will go forward and bring forth godly seed. And in these days in Israel, it was to protect that inheritance that was granted to them by God. And so we see here then what a noble woman Ruth was. And Boaz was saying that to her. This testimony of yours is better than the fact that you gleaned in the fields like a common worker. This testimony says that you'll marry me. You'll marry me for a child to fulfill this law and to care for your mother-in-law. What a beautiful picture. Now, we see here the nobility of Ruth's testimony in the following of Christ and the obedience to the Word of God. How do we know that we know Christ? Because we follow on to do His commandments. If we love Him, we will obey Him. We will be like Him. How do we know we're Christians? Because we obey Him. And that's what Ruth did. She said, I'm going to your country, Naomi. Your God is going to be my God. And your people are going to be my people. And she went to Bethlehem and she proved that testimony. She worked according to the law in the fields. Now she's invoking, according to the law, her right to raise a name up for her dead husband, so that that name, that property, will never pass out of that family. What a picture of salvation. And so we see here then that Boaz, in verse 11, says, I will do to thee all that thou requirest. And he says, all of the people of my city know that you're a virtuous woman. Boaz's response betrays his own consideration for Ruth because he assures her that he will do everything he can. And it's at this point that we may glimpse a genuine love for her and no doubt Ruth's for Boaz. He continues to speak of her virtue and the fact that she was willing to even come down to this threshing floor. And so no doubt she has the regard for Naomi. She has this beautiful testimony that she will obey the law. But the fact that she would come down and come down there to the threshing floor for Boaz could be a hint also of her own love. Now, in verse 12, we see, and now it's true that I am thy near kinsman, howbeit there's one nearer than I. It's possible that Boaz is telling Ruth something that she wasn't aware of, and that he was not the nearest of kin. He was probably a cousin of her dead husband's, but a closer kin would have been his uncle, the brother of Elimelech. And that was the order of the Redeemer. The father's brother, then the full cousin, then the other blood relatives going down. So strictly speaking, the law only required brothers to raise up seed to the dead brother by taking the widow. If you didn't have a brother left, you, strictly speaking, you weren't even under that obligation. In Unger's Bible Dictionary, he says that the Mosaic provision was as follows. If brothers on the father's side and one of them died childless, the wife was not to go outside and marry, but she was to marry, the surviving brother was to take her. In the case the brother-in-law did not wish to marry the widow, she might cite him legally, and we read that. And but then he says that the marriage was not strictly commanded, but was considered a duty, or the divine sanction of the Mosaic law gave to this marriage is not required. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself here. From Ruth 4, 1 through 10, it would appear that in the case of the refusal of the brother-in-law to take the widow, then the next male relative had the right to do so. The divine sanction which the Mosaic law gave to this marriage is not to be regarded as merely an accommodation to a popular prejudice. Such marriage was not strictly commanded, but it was considered a duty of love, the non-fulfillment of which brought reproach and ridicule on the man and his house. Trying to get the rabbins taught that in the neck. Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here. The brother's house then was the one that was held accountable, and if he refused to do it, then it was brought as a dishonor on his house. But apart from the brother, you don't find that requirement is made on the other relatives, only to redeem the property. But here we have Boaz, who wasn't a brother. He was not even an uncle. He was probably, at best, a cousin. He told her to wait there in verse 13, tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of the kinsman to thee as the Lord liveth. Lie down until the morning. And she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. Also he said, bring the veil that thou hast with thee upon thee, and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley, and laid it on her, and she went to the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, who art thou, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Then said she, being Naomi, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he have finished the thing this day. So we see in verse 13 that he told her to wait there for the night, probably as a precaution that she be not found in the streets of Bethlehem in the hour of the night. And he promised that he would follow through and do the part of the kinsman in the morning. And we're going to leave it right there. We'll break off and we'll finish this because we've gone over time, and I appreciate your patience. There's one thing that I would like to leave you with before we break off. He told her to bring the veil, and he measured out 6 measures. And then she went into the city. We don't know how much he gave her, but we know it was enough that she couldn't pick the veil up. He had to pick it up. And it's interesting that the only commentator that we could find, and John helped me look, and even even the Hebrew translation doesn't agree with what Dr. Gill says here. He says that in this translation, and she went into the city, it's actually the masculine form of the pronoun, meaning that Boaz accompanied her into Bethlehem in order to keep her safe because it was still dark. But he is the only one who brings that to light. But I want to end right here with this, and we'll pick back up on the beautiful ending of this and then go into chapter 4, God willing, the next time, with the fact that although we don't know how much 6 measures were, we know, listen to this, and he said, bring the veil that thou hast upon him. When she held it out, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. Do you think that God's blessings are ever paltry? He measured out in the darkness of that threshing floor, no doubt as they whispered to one another, so much barley that he had to pick the veil up and lay it on her after he filled it up. What a blessing. When we go to the Lord, he gives us more than we could ever imagine. He has done that. He's given us more than we can even imagine. We won't even know until we get to glory. But the beauty of our Redeemer, and when he gives us, as the Song of Solomon says, tokens of his love, they're so full that he must pick them up and carry them for us. What a great blessing. And so as we close today, I hope that this will give you meditation and blessing for this week as you think about the beauty of Ruth's testimony and the gentleness of Boaz and the promise of the Redeemer.